And welcome to another edition of Book Talk. I'm Stephen Usery, and it's my pleasure to welcome Mary Laura Philpott back to the program today. Mary Laura is the founding editor of the in-house magazine for Parnassus Books in Nashville, Tennessee. She is also co-host of A Word on Words for Nashville Public Television, and first appeared on Book Talk for her collection of cartoons, Penguins with People Problems. Today we'll talk about her new book, a collection of essays entitled I Miss You When I Blink, which is published by Atria Books. Mary Laura, before in your book, Penguins People Problems, you could hide your insecurities behind some flightless waterfowl. So why did you decide to step out from behind a penguin and let everyone know everything that you're afraid of?
That I am a real person. I've gotten some really funny direct messages on social media from people who go, are you the same person that did that penguin book? I am the same person who did the penguin book. And the penguins were very much based on me and people I know. But this book just is me and people I know. This is the kind of stuff I have been writing for years and years and years, and was writing already. Essays are just the thing I do. I'm a kind of a one-trick pony, and that's my trick. I've been writing essays for years. The Penguin book popped up in the middle of my adult creative life as a wonderful, delightful lark, just to mix my bird metaphors. I was drawing those for fun and putting them on the internet, and a book deal fell out of the sky from Penguin Random House. This book, I miss
a little
you.
On the nose.
Right, I know. I can't help it. We're going to talk about birds. It just came flying out and landed on me, is how it happened. I Miss You When I Blink is a culmination of work that I was doing sort of over a much longer time and more intentionally.
And it's unusual, because when you decided you wanted to be a writer, you didn't want to be a journalist or a novelist. And that seems like the two most prominent avenues people pursue.
Right. They were the only avenues I knew existed, which just goes to show you how ignorant I was as a college student. But I thought, well, I guess if you love writing, you're either a reporter, and then you have to go, you know, fact check all that stuff, which sounded awful, or you're a novelist. And I have never had an urge or known how to write fiction. So I thought, oh, well, there are no writing jobs for me, which explains part of why it took me so long in my early adulthood to find my way back to writing and realize that there are ways you can write that are not journalism or fiction.
Maybe you just didn't want to write about other people.
Maybe that's it.
Out of kindness, not out of a sense of egocentrism.
Or both, whatever.
You don't bury it in the middle or even at the end. The title essay comes up first.
Yes.
So a blink happens about 1/10 of a second. So how much have you missed me since the interview began?
So much. And you're just right here across the table. So that essay actually moved around in the manuscript. I started with it at the beginning, and then I thought, no, I don't want this at the beginning. I want the first essay to be a story, like a here's a thing that happened kind of story. So I shunted it off to the end. And then I didn't like that it was at the end, because in describing what this title means and why this is the title for the book, it sets up so much of what I go through emotionally in this book. And so I pulled it back to the beginning. It kept bouncing all over the place. It finally ended up where I think it belongs, which is right at the start of the book.
So you have kind of have this in media array story at the beginning, but then it moves fairly chronologically after that.
Right. I go back and forth on whether books really need prologues, and I think some books do and some books don't, but that first essay sort of functions as a prologue.
So tell us all about what Missing People When They Blink is all about.
Oh, well, it's something that my son said when he was 6. He is now a teenager. He is much taller than me. But when he was little, he threw this phrase out, just a little kind of throwaway piece of nonsense, while he was scribbling on a piece of paper. He was making a poem, and he wrote, I miss you in the sink, and I miss you in the skating rink, and I miss you when I blink. And I heard him say it, and it just stopped my thought process right then and stuck in my head like a song lyric. And I took his little piece of paper that he had been scribbling on, and I put it up on the wall in my office. And I walked past it every day for years, this little scrap of paper that said, I miss you when I blink, in this pencil scrawl. And the combination of seeing it every day and then just living the years that I was living then, which I was in my 30s, I had little kids, I was doing a lot of work, I was juggling a lot of different roles in my life. It came to take on all this extra meaning that there's no way he could have intended as a 6-year-old, but it somehow attached itself to my obsession with time and how time moves so much faster the older you get, and how I miss things about my younger self, but I also miss things about the self I intended to be but didn't quite turn out to be. I miss things about lives I didn't even live. So I carried around this phrase, and it had all this big emotional meaning, and it was the title for this book before I even knew what the book would be. It was It was a title I carried around thinking I have to stick this to something.
I bet you're grateful that you can't copyright titles so he can't ask you for any money.
He was very young, and I totally got him to agree to it for, like, the cost of an ice cream cone. It's like, can I use that? Thank you. He's proud, I think.
Will you ever let him read the book?
He has read pieces of it. Both my children have read pieces of it. Neither of them has shown an interest in reading the whole thing, and I'm certainly not going to force it on them. I don't think when I was a teenager, I would have cared to read a whole book by my mom about my mom. It just wouldn't have been what I was interested in. So they'll probably reach an age at some point where they want to read it, or they won't, and that's fine.
So has your mother read it?
My mother has read it. Both my parents have read it. I sent it to them to read once I sold it. So it was going to be a book. There was no going back. They read it and they are wonderfully supportive. I had a private conversation with each of them. They were so supportive, so gracious. There have been a couple of reviews that mention my mom. There's one in Garden and Gun that just came out that said something like, among the high points is the story of Philpott's mother. My mom was like, did you see that review? It was so good.
You do have some thoughts about the way you were raised.
Yeah.
And whether it was positive or negative.
Right.
And that there were advantages and drawbacks.
Right.
And so I was just wondering how she felt about that section.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you're right. I said there, especially in an essay that's called Wonder Woman, I talk about how I kind of became a baby perfectionist growing up in this household where grades were very important. And, you know, the thing is, I had a brother who grew up in the same house. He did not turn out to be as much of a type A perfectionist workaholic sort of person as I am. So we clearly can't blame it on the household and the way we were raised. But I do ask the question in that essay, how much of who I am now came from the way I was parented? And it's an interesting essay, I think, because I sort of tell the story twice. I tell it one way and say, once upon a time, I was this kid and I was raised this way by my mother and these things happened. And in conclusion, everything that's wrong with me is my mother's fault. And then I start the essay over and I say, once upon a time, I was a little kid and my mother raised me and did these things. And in conclusion, everything that is great about me is to my mother's credit. And both of those things are true, but also neither of them is exactly true. And I think it took becoming an adult and a parent myself to be able to look back and see that time with more empathy, certainly, than I might have had earlier.
So what have you done with that perfectionism drive when it comes to raising your own kids?
I say this in the book, but I made an effort when they were really little and they went off to preschool and they were starting sort of the beginning of their academic careers. I said, I am not going to be that parent who asks the minute they got home what they get on their math test or their English test or whatever. I'm going to come up with a different go-to question. And so for some reason, I settled on, what did you have for lunch? Like, I thought that's an innocuous thing to chat about. So every day they would come home, they'd get in the car and I would go, well, what did you have for lunch today? And they would tell me what they had for lunch. It is now many, many years later. Still the first thing we talk about is what they had for lunch. And so my editor and I have been joking about, you know, in about a decade or two, we're going to have a book from one of my kids where they say, I have a strange relationship with food because my mother asked me what I had for lunch every single day of my childhood. But that's kind of my way of mitigating my own perfectionist tendencies. I may still look at my own day and go, what did you accomplish today? But I at least have the self-awareness and restraint to try not to put that same pressure on my kids so that they can look at a day and evaluate it based on what kind of day it was and what they felt and all the different things that happened and not just what did I produce today.
Well, and you can ask that question of yourself and it not be a demanding question. You can say, hey, what have I gotten done today?
You can. Yeah. You can ask it and not go, and how does that equal my self-worth? Absolutely.
So how have you balanced the drive toward perfectionism with actually getting things done?
Oh, it's hard. I don't know that I have perfected the balance. It helps to have multiple projects going on. I guess it helps and it hurts. If I have multiple projects going on and one is a big amorphous thing, say writing a book that takes many years, and then you have projects where you can complete smaller tasks every single day, juggling those two and doing a little bit of the job that is made up of more small, discrete tasks helps because then there's something that I've done that day that I can check off and go, you know, great, I wrote these three paragraphs about this book for my newsletter or whatever, got that done. And it makes me feel better about the fact that when I sat down to work on my book that day, maybe I deleted more words than I actually wrote. So I'm not fixing my, I haven't figured out how to fix my perfectionism or the way that my self-worth is all tied up in my work, but I have figured out how to sort of game my own mental system a little bit.
In that stress of perfectionism, mm-hmm. you're probably inside, just crawling out of your skin almost. But on the outside, you're projecting the sense of calm and mm-hmm. competency to your friends and family. But then did that set up a cycle of where you didn't feel like you were really being seen? Because yeah. your presentation was different from what was inside.
Totally, which is such a lonely feeling. And I feel like I've had so many conversations with my friends where they have had the same thing, where they go, gosh, everybody thinks I have it all together and I'm a mess. I mean, I'm having that right now, actually. Like, I'm on book tour right now, and I've got my book tour outfits all set, and I get up early in my hotel, and I dry my hair so that it's not crazy, and I post the happy, happy pictures on social media. While also, on the inside, I am constantly stressed about, am I in the right airport at the right time? Am I on the way to the right city? Will people show up at the event tonight? How many books did I sell? I don't even want to look at the number, but I want to know the number. A question that came up early on in this tour, and it was one of my favorite questions, came from Mari Andrew, who is a cartoonist and memoirist. She was my conversation partner at Books Are Magic in New York, and she said, how could I, speaking of herself, as a non-type A person, better have empathy for you type A control freak people? And I said, just bear in mind that when you look at us and we look like we have it all together and we're all smiley and successful and perfect and, you know, our purse matches our shoes and all this stuff, part of that may not be because we do have it together or because we somehow think we're better than anybody else and that's why we have to have it all together. People who are like me, we might have something broken in our brains that tells us you have to get everything exactly right, even all these things that don't even matter, just to prove that you deserve to be here. That's a weird little broken thing in our brains, but it's something to keep in mind when you're looking at people and thinking, oh, she looks like she's got it all together. It's sort of the same as, you know how we always say, be kind because you never know what battles people are fighting that you can't see. We say that about people who look like they're a mess or people who are being mean. We say, look, get, you know, cut them a little slack. You don't know what they're going through. I would say extend that to everybody. Extend it to people who look like they have it all together on the outside because they too may have battles going on that you can't see.
And I learned that sympathy or empathy for you in reading the book, and you seemingly do have it all. Great job, great husband, great kids. But then I read you first saw your husband at a Hootie and the Blowfish concert, and boy, my heart went out to you.
In a college gym, no less. Yeah, hold my hand. We got tickets to the reunion tour because we just have to, you know.
But how do you go about in a person that tries to present a collected image than to make yourself vulnerable and lay all these insecurities bare in front of strangers?
The more practice I have with it, the easier it is. And the more practice I have with it in person, the more confidence, like in small conversations, just you and me talking on the sidewalk, the more confidence I have about doing it in writing for a greater audience. And certainly, while I was writing the book, there was part of me that thought, A, what if no one cares? B, what if everybody does care, but they care in a bad way, and they go, this is terrible. What if they judge me? What if whatever? It was a risk. But now that the book is out, I am hearing from so many people through social media, through my website, through emails, just at events, who say, you wrote all these things that I feel and I think, and I didn't know other people felt this way. And that has been so validating and has made me feel like, okay, the risk was worth it. When you get that kind of reception and that kind of reaction, it is encouraging and it makes me think, okay, I could keep doing this because it's people do want to read this. It's making them feel like they've been seen.
But how does that tie into your need for validation when you were young, needing approval by being perfect mm-hmm. and getting attention for that? And now you're getting attention for
right,
for that.
Right. I'm just gaming the system. Like, I never did figure out how to not need approval. I need approval all the time. I am at least self-aware enough to know that I need approval and to know that I like it when people think I have done a good job, but I totally need it. That's one of the downsides to working in a creative industry is if you are a creative person and also someone who needs approval, oof, you're putting yourself at risk every single day. That's just how it goes.
Well, also with publishing, having long cycles, and you know, you're not going to be putting out a book every day. So
right, or even every year.
How do you get that approval otherwise?
Right, exactly. Yeah, you're just waiting. That's where the little jobs come in, you know, having a day job or doing some other projects or publishing some small things here and there. That's where the approval comes from. Or, you know, you get it from yourself. You learn to tell yourself, okay, you wrote 500 words today. You deleted 475 of them, but you've got 25 great words to sit down to tomorrow and keep going.
And so you're able to do that now?
I try.
You wrote about some of the difficulties your family had when they moved to Ireland for a few months. Can you tell some of the positives that happened while
you
were there?
Yeah. So this was when my kids were babies, and my husband, he ran the international division of a company. And so for the certain chunk of our lives, when I was a freelance writer and we had teeny tiny kids and he had this job, he was gone all the time. So, you know, we always joke about how my daughter, when she learned to walk, she would toddle up to my desk in our house and pull up and look into the computer screen and go, "Daddy?" Because she thought he lived in the Skype screen. That was our life for a few years in a row. So when he got this chance to be in one place for a while, that place happened to be Dublin, Ireland, we just went over with him because we thought this is our chance for all four of us to be in the same house for a few months and get to spend some time together. So, I mean, the best upside was that all four of us got to see more of each other than we had seen in years. And that was really fun. It was neat to see my older child who was old enough to remember it. He was 3 and he turned 4 while we were there. It was neat to see him seeing a different place. Like, you know how it's fun to experience something new yourself, but to see a child experience something for the first time is like that wonder squared. So that was fun, but it was also lonely. And I think I don't know what I assumed. I assumed I would get over there and just magically make friends, and I couldn't find friends. And then also, I kind of forgot about the fact that, you know, my life that I'd had in Atlanta, which was freelance writing, a very solitary activity, raising babies / toddlers, also very solitary because they're napping a lot and you have to stay home. You can't just lock them in the house and leave them there to nap. That was still my reality. So I was still lonely in a house. I was just lonely in a house across the ocean versus lonely in a house where I started out. But we did have some wonderful times and some wonderful memories, and we have a great scrapbook of moments, taking a little field trip out to see castles or that kind of thing. My daughter took her first steps over there, so that was neat.
And now with your children becoming teenagers, mm-hmm. How does that feel when they don't need you as much?
Oh, it's the worst. It's the worst. Why don't they want me to read to them every night? I don't know. It's just awful. How does anyone survive their children going away to college? I don't know. Because all those years where it's so hard and they're little and you have to cut up all their food into tiny bites and you have to bathe them and all this physical exertion goes into raising them, that's so hard. And then they go through this sort of preteen phase where they're just buttheads. And then they come out of it and they're delightful. They're my favorite people to be around right now. And in a few years, they're going to be gone. I don't know how anybody survives it.
Now, there was a point where you met up with some women who are fellow professionals and mm-hmm. very accomplished in all their fields, and they started talking about quotidian domestic things. And you were going, why can't we talk about something more than this?
The chicken salad incident, yeah, as it has come to be called.
Now, I have strong feelings on chicken salad.
You know, who doesn't?
Do you think that was just people hiding their own securities and we can talk about this neutral thing and not have to expose ourselves?
I think a huge part of it was that. In fact, I've had so many really neat conversations since the book has come out about that one scene in that one essay, the chicken salad incident, the dinner party where the entire table talked about chicken salad for something like 19 minutes. And I sat there losing my mind. Now that people have read that, I've had friends come up and say either what you just said, which is, I was just going along with the chicken salad talk because I thought everyone else was too, and it seemed like something we could all talk about. Or I've also had friends who said, hey, I went through the chicken salad conversations at that time in my life because that's the phase I was in. I was in a very domestic phase of life. I had to feed all these people. I actually did care about chicken salad, and there's nothing wrong with that. And the follow-up conversations that I've had have really clarified one of the things that I talk about in that essay, which is that so many times we can think we don't understand each other or that we are different from everyone around us. Like, oh, everyone thinks this and I think this, I'm alone. When really we're just out of sync with each other a little bit, and we're in different phases. And I might be going through a phase where I do want to talk about chicken salad all the time, and you might not. And if you sit us down at a table together for 20 minutes, talking about chicken salad that whole time is going to be fun for me and awful for you. And it doesn't mean we don't understand each other and we're totally different people. It just means we're in two very different phases at that moment.
You've talked about these insecurities, and they kind of came to a head. So you've got this great life, seems stable, and wow, hey, here's a midlife crisis coming on.
Mm-hmm. Well, when I first started putting these essays together, I thought I might be building toward that time that you're talking about, which was in my mid to late 30s, where I kind of looked around and went, this life I am living is not what I recognize as the life I meant to live, and I don't like it, and I feel alone, and I feel lost, and I feel anxious. But what I found as I was writing these essays is that I had smaller versions of that many times in adulthood, starting at like 22. I've talked to a lot of friends about this, and I have this theory, you know, it's not social science, I haven't actually measured it, but I have a theory that starting around 21, 22, when we get out of school, every five-ish years, we go through some sort of identity crisis, whether it's the, what do I want to do for my career, or oops, I did that thing that I thought I wanted to do for my career for 5 years, and it was a terrible choice. Now what am I going to do? Or getting in and out of a relationship, or I think I'm ready to have kids, or I think I want to get a divorce, or I think I want to go back to school. So that time in my life that you're talking about where I looked up and went, I don't recognize myself right now, and I'm very unhappy, was really just a slightly magnified version of something I had felt many other times, and that my friends and I had talked about many other times. And it seems to me that although we talk about the midlife crisis as this thing that happens all the time, I think what is much more common are these little identity crises that just happen on a rolling basis, I guess forever. I don't know. I'm in my mid-40s now, and I've had many people come up to me at events on this tour who are in their 60s and say, hey, look, bad news. I got to tell you, it's just going to keep happening, which is sort of depressing. But also kind of good to know that there's nothing wrong with me or there's nothing wrong with you if you're having these identity crises along the way. This is maybe just how it goes, and it will go this way forever.
And I was thinking the other day about how much we've made fun of men over the years because of the way they tend to handle these crises.
Right, right.
But the feelings behind them are real and need to be addressed.
Oh, they're so real. They're real and they need to be addressed, and they need to be addressed every time they happen. They need to be taken seriously when they happen. I think one reason why the crisis that hits closer to midlife is seen as the big one for a lot of people might be that they're pushing the other ones down when they happen earlier and going, nope, not going to listen to that voice that's telling me I may have wandered off the course I meant to set. Just going to push that down and keep going. And then it blows up bigger.
25 was the worst one for me.
Was it?
Yeah, 25 was terrible. And after that, it's been all right.
Then it's been good. I keep hearing that 30 is a big one. I keep getting messages from readers who are 30-year-old, especially women who are 30, and are having like a big kind of coming to Jesus with themselves about who they meant to be and then who they are and what they want to do next. So I don't know.
Now, you name check Nora Ephron.
Yeah.
And that she didn't quite understand you personally.
Well, she had this line. I love her book so much. I really love her nonfiction, but I loved her fiction too. Heartburn. I think the first time I read Heartburn, I was in seventh grade. Why I wanted to read that in seventh grade, I don't know, but I did. But she has this line that says something like, show me a person who cries when the leaves fall and I'll show you a real a-hole. And the first time I read it, I didn't really think anything of it. But when I reread that book as an adult, I was like, wait a minute. I cry when leaves fall. And it kicked that thought that I had one night lying on my sofa reading Heartburn, kicked off that essay. The one you're talking about is called Nora Ephron and the Lives of Trees, where I sort of justify why I get upset about things that happen in nature and why I'm so attached to trees and animals and how the animal world and the natural world and the human world are all tied together for me. And because I'm such a people pleaser and such a type A person and I want to get everybody's A+, I sort of write this essay as if I'm arguing my point to Nora Ephron. Like, listen, let me just explain it. Then you will not think I'm an a-hole. Of course, I can't do that because she's gone. But yeah.
But did you ever consider that you just might be an A+ hole?
I might be.
Who are some other essayists that have been influential to you and that you've enjoyed over the years?
Oh, gosh. She's a big one. David Rakoff was so good. Oh, man, I wish he were still around so we could still have new books from him. He was so good at telling stories that balanced just hilarious tiny observations with this existential pathos. I have a joke with my agent that all my essays start and end the same way, that they all start with, hey, you want to hear a funny story? And they end with, and in conclusion, we're all going to die. And he had a way of doing that that was just so perfectly well balanced. And I've read and reread his book so many times, and I really don't reread very often. I know I just said I reread Nora Ephron. Probably she and David Rakoff and maybe one or two others are the only people I reread. David Sedaris, of course. But he's his own thing. You can't ever attempt to put yourself in the same category as David Sedaris. But you can read his work and just observe the genius of it all. Other essayists. I mean, if you're looking more recently, I would say I Am, I Am, I Am by Maggie O'Farrell is probably the best memoir and essays I've read in the past year. I loved How to Write an Autobiographical Novel by Alexander Chee. I think it's just perfect. There are so many good examples around me. And being a reader and having access to a bookstore where I can get those books as soon as they come out has been a luxury.
Since the last time we spoke, you've gotten into my line of work a little bit.
A little bit.
You're interviewing authors for public TV in Nashville, so
yes.
How's that going?
It's really fun. So Nashville Public Television is just this wonderful team of people who care so much about what they do, and they're so smart, and they're so good, and they have like garages full of Emmys for this work that they do. So I feel like I'm in very safe hands, even though I do not have the experience that you have in interviewing people. They've made it, well, I do in that I usually interview people for written interviews, but the kind of live thing I hadn't had as much experience with, but they make it so easy. You know, they set everything up and they remind me of when I need to send my questions in and when I need to send an invoice. Just as jobs go, they make that so easy so that then when we have the moment where we're sitting down having the interview, my guest and I, it just feels like a conversation because I'm not stressed about any other element of what's going on.
Well, I've found over the years people don't really consider the performative aspect of it.
Yeah.
As much.
Yeah.
But I have to ask you the questions, but I have to ask them in an intelligible way that sounds interesting.
Right, right. And we have to kind of build this conversation into something that has some sort of narrative thread because somebody's going to listen to this later as a piece of entertainment. And it's been really delightful to work with the team that takes care of so much of it so that I can focus on that.
I will say you have one advantage. When I do them occasionally for our television station, mm-hmm. There's no editing.
Oh,
it's
my word.
28 minutes, get the job done.
Holy moly. So there's a lot of editing in ours, obviously, because we film about 20, 25 minutes of conversation. And what actually airs is closer to 4 minutes because it's, I call it the show between shows. It's an interstitial. It's what you see on public television instead of big blocks of ads. You get this nice, short, original content. So there's a lot of editing. I'm actually really, really impressed at how they edit that much conversation into something that small because it always works. When you watch these little episodes, it's like, oh, that really coheres and works together, but that's strung together from a much bigger thing.
With my interviews, it's normally about 40 minutes that mm-hmm. we cut down to 28.
Wow.
And almost any conversation on this planet can be taken 15%. You can just take off right off
yeah,
the top.
Yeah, yeah, that's true.
Being a host, mm-hmm. has that changed the way you're a guest?
I don't know if it has changed the way that I'm a guest, but it has certainly made it less nerve-wracking. I have spoken with other authors who are out touring. I was just at the LA Times Festival of Books and I got to see a bunch of writer friends. And some of them are very nervous about being interviewed, very nervous about being on panels. And that doesn't make me nervous because I'm used to it. I'm used to being in your seat, the seat you're in right now versus the seat I'm in. But those seats really aren't very different. If the conversation gets going and you're talking and it's going well, it just feels like a conversation, no matter which side you're on.
Last year when I did my 600th interview.
600?
Yeah.
Wow.
I got interviewed for that, and I hated it.
You did?
I did so much.
Why? Because you weren't in control of it, or why?
Also, I just don't have too much to say. You know, I talked a little bit now about the performative aspect, blah, 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 writing the questions. But beyond writing the questions and sequencing them in a nice way, which almost never follow once the interview gets going, there's just not much to say. I read a book and ask some questions. And
Well, but you've had to fill in, I'm sure, in 600 episodes. You've had some guests where they're not as forthcoming as you might hope, and you've had to fill the conversation in a little bit, right?
Yeah, a couple times.
Okay. Sometimes I tell myself that's what I'm doing. Like when I'm being interviewed, to make sure that I'm not nervous, I'm like, this is just like if I'm the interviewer, except I've got to keep the conversation going because for some reason the other person's not talking.
It's all about y'all. It's not about me.
It's fun. It's whichever seat I'm in, it is always fun to talk about books, whether they're my books or someone else's books, although I have been talking about my book a lot, so it's going to be fun to get back home and talk about other people's for a while.
But now we want to talk about your next book.
I would love to talk about my next book if I knew what it was. I don't know. Maybe another collection of essays. If it's anything, it's another collection of essays. That's what I know how to do. And that's also how my brain organizes its thoughts. I am one of those people who doesn't know what I'm writing until I've written it, and I write in order to figure out what I think about something. A lot of my essays ended up in a different place than I thought they would. And something about that form, the constraints of it, and how it sort of forces you to write and think economically and efficiently and wrestle with whatever you're wrestling with and then get finished wrestling with it and move on to another thing and then make all those little things sort of be in conversation with each other. Something about that form just works for the way I think. So I hope I can do another one, another collection. We'll have to see. I have to just take it essay by essay.
Here's a 10-cent idea. A novel in essays.
I can't write fiction. Stephen, this is what happens when I write fiction. I go, once upon a time, in a place that totally does not exist, that I am making up right now, this thing happened, just kidding, it was yesterday, it was me, here's what it was. Like, I cannot maintain the facade.
But you could use that to your advantage in the,
I guess,
in the piece.
And just pretend it's fiction, but really it's not fiction.
Well, and just mix it up so much that right, no one knows anymore.
Just go in and do a replace all on the names and be like, oh, see, it's fiction. I made it up. It's not my name. It can't be me.
Well, Mary Laura, I want to thank you so much for coming back to Book Talk. It has been a pleasure.
Thank you for having me. This was fun.
Mary Laura Philpott is the author of I Miss You When I Blink, which is published by Atria Books. I'm Stephen Usry, and this is Book Talk.
Thank you for joining us today. Book Talk is recorded in the studios of WIPL in Memphis, Tennessee. If you have any questions or comments, you can email us at WIPLFM@gmail.com or write to us at Book Talk, care of WIPL, 3030 Poplar Avenue, Memphis, Tennessee, 38111, or call us at 901-415-2752.
This recording of Book Talk is licensed under the Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivative Works 3.0 license for the United States. You are free to share, copy, distribute, or display and perform this work. But there are restrictions. Nothing in this license impairs or restricts WYPL's moral rights. Thank you for listening to Book Talk.